Good afternoon. Congratulations, Inter Economics. It's been a very long day, and my experience from the last session was very much like I remember what Juncker used to say before he was president, that we know exactly what to do, but we don't know how to win elections. I mean, what today proves that we don't know what to do, let alone win elections. And what I want to do today, because, I mean, if we don't know what to do, and as Daniel Grosdas said, we don't have, you know, the right frameworks to understand, you know, zero interest rate for the next 3 decades. So we need to have new conceptions, new frameworks. But the problem is, once you talk, you address an audience, you need to have a framework nevertheless. But I want to bracket that at the beginning, saying, you know, this might not be the right framework. But what I would like to say in particular today, and I think that's been some kind of experiential learning over the past decade, that we used to believe, or we, I mean, I'm talking about policymakers, we had a very benign understanding of the functionalities of capital markets. And we had a very mean or malignant understanding of the welfare state. And we had this notion that if you organize your financial sector well and support that with, you know, a fiscal policy and monetary policy that would sort hold, you know, wasteful welfare states in check, that was the way to go ahead, and then you get trickle-down economics and what have you. And I think we need to revisit that. We need to think about the welfare state in a way that it can be quite productive, and we need to be a little bit more wary of the functions of capital markets. So that's where I want to pitch my message. So my title was that social investment, you know, that EMU is not ready for social investment, and I still believe that. But I, on the other hand, I want to also give a bit of a positive message, and I changed the title of my talk into, you know, let's make social investment happen for the Eurozone. I will come to the solution of that, you know, according to my framework, of course, later. But, you know, over the past 2 decades, we've seen a major evolution in thinking about social policy from, you know, the perspective of only distribution to something that you can call a productive factor, to the sort of social investment policy paradigm that was launched in particular under Laszlo Andor as commissioner. But if you look at the documentation of the OECD over the past decade already, from babies and bosses to, you know, we're in it together, I mean, there's a very strong anchor of social investment in there. And then, you know, all international organizations are now turning to inclusive growth. I mean, it's, and again, that makes me kind of wonder. I mean, we just had a session in which it was said that, you know, the left is sort of, you know, up in arms, and the OECD and the IMF, you know, after a number of Nobel Prizes been given to true neoliberal thinkers, you know, they kind of jumped on the bandwagon. I mean, there was they were followers of fashion, and what can you expect? And now, you know, the only social democrats around in the world today are, in fact, at the IMF, at the OECD, and in part at the EU. So that's a very surprising development. And again, it reflects the uncertainty of the age, in a way. And then, of course, you know, there's cumulative diffusion of the social investment perspective, going from the Nordic countries, which used to be thought of as, you know, the exceptions to the rule. But, you know, this is happening in Germany and the Netherlands and Belgium and Austria. And it's not happening in Italy and Greece for maybe obvious reasons. And the obvious reasons do have to do with the way we designed EMU. But again, you know, everybody is now, you know, a cheerleader for social investment. But at the end of the day, if there are economic hard times, austerity should prevail, right? Stop here. Let's cut first and then see what we can do in terms of industrial policy or social policy. And Again, you know, I think this may not be the right answer. And a really nice sort of representative of this kind of thinking is, of course, Angela Merkel, when she said, you know, the European Union accounts for 70% of the world's population. That's not too much. 25% of the world's GDP, that's a lot. But over 50% of its welfare spending. And again, you know, the implication is, you know, big welfare states are uncompetitive. But then if you look at the website of the World Economic Forum, where she held this speech in 2013, and you look at the top 10 of the most competitive economies, then, you know, five of them, if you include Switzerland, are social investment welfare states. Now, does the welfare state have anything to do with the competitive position of a country like Germany? And what is funny from my perspective as a sort of a social investment researcher is that Angela Merkel was very important, and von der Leyen as well, in changing family policy, leave policy, childcare policy, et cetera, in this country. Yet, you know, she is completely oblivious in her speech about, you know, what that contributes. You know, if you raise the level of female employment by allowing them into the labor market less interrupted, then that's a big change in terms of endogenous economic growth. But even though she thought this was important policies, probably for political reasons, she doesn't understand the economic logic of it. So again, it shows how frameworks that we have are sort of so deeply ingrained, and it's very difficult to get rid of them. And of course, you can say on the basis of the league table, okay, you know, maybe the error runs in reverse, that big welfare states are actually good for the economy. Yes, that's in part true, you know, given the examples. But then, you know, Italy and France spending 30% of GDP are not, you know, in the top 10 and not in the top 40, I would think. So, I mean, here, of course, Merkel has a point. But the point then should be, it's not the quantity of social spending, but it's the quality. And we should really look carefully into that quality before we make up our minds in terms of to the extent that the welfare state adds to growth or economic competitiveness. Now, where Angela Merkel's thinking is coming from in this country, ordo-liberalism, is, you know, the idea that, you know, competitiveness is best served by undistorted market competition, and that in the back there is this notion that there is an inescapable trade-off between equity and efficiency. So if you want to be efficient, you should really hold the welfare state in check, because, you know, there's a tension there. And clearly, you know, the experience of the 1970s, when some countries had, you know, unemployment benefits of about 90% of last earned wages, that really, has a point. But, you know, if it's 60 or 75% attached to strong conditionalities, that is no, the moral hazard problem is no longer, you know, that much of an issue. And the policy instrumentarium, which makes, again, perfect sense, you need, you know, tough fiscal policy, zero deficits, and then underpin that with, you know, supply-side liberalization. So the combination of the single market and EMU were really designed at the time, given the experience of stagflation of the 1970s, to hold these welfare states in check and to be very suspicious about what the state can do. I mean, and that's why there was a very negative image of industrial policy at the time, and probably rightfully so. Because, you know, you had to deal with these rent-seeking institutions, call them trade unions. There is the BOMO cost disease. There is moral hazard that you can't control. And a lot of dead weight loss if you pursue active labor market policy, which, you know, we're all doing around the world today. And the political discourse was, you know, there really is no alternative. And you know, with smaller letters, it was said inequality is actually good for competitiveness. So that's actually what you want in terms of, you know, raising levels of employment and growth. Now, the social investment perspective developed in the shadow of that policy theory.
In Hinsicht auf die Howard.
Somebody's speaking to me. And so the emancipation of the social investment perspective as a paradigm in and of itself was quite subdued by this force of this inescapable trade-off between equity and efficiency. So, you know, the social investment perspective as a paradigm, the political objective is not on the sort of market competition, but raising family-friendly employment over the life course to sustain popular but nevertheless aging welfare states and thereby, as the ultimate goal, break the intergenerational reproduction of social disadvantage. If you look at European surveys, and, you know, we've talked a lot about different countries and where they are, and, you know, the differences are huge. But if you do an opinion poll and ask young people what they would like to have out of their lives, it's all the same. They want a job. They know that they will change jobs a number of times over their lifetime. They want, you know, some kind of basic pension. And they also understand that it will be given to them, you know, by the age of 70. That doesn't seem to be a problem with the younger generation. They want 2.3 children. And for their children, they want good education. And for themselves and their children, they want good health care. I mean, this is very simple. And these are converging aspirations across Europe. Now, if we look at the performance of different countries, then clearly some countries do not live up to that, and it has to do with the institutions, and whether it's EMU or the structure of the Italian welfare state, I'll come to that later. But essentially, Europeans want the same thing. So if the European institution can kind of help to reach those aspirations, that would be a really big bonus. But that's not the world we're talking about today. So the policy theory of the social investment perspective is quite the opposite from the neoliberal perspective, because social investments crowd in private economic initiative through higher employment rates. And we saw the graph of Daniel, and this is the first time after the crisis that the EU employment rate has sort of transgressed that of the US. And it's a quite significant social effect. And the policy instruments are, you know, policy mixes that kind of mitigate these gender-sensitive life course contingencies in the labor market in particular and in family. And you have to do that ex ante rather than ex post. So there's a shift from thinking about social protection towards what you can call social promotion. And in the governance structure, you know, it's really seeking out these productive coalitions at various levels of administration. I mean, not all public administration is stupid, as we know. And even this is what Theresa May said last week at her party conference as well, which is quite new to the Conservatives. And the political discourse is one about capacitating, so active social justice and equity. And I think there's one thing that we need to point out, because, you know, the welfare state debate, and also today we talked a lot, and rightfully so, we talked a lot about redistribution, and that sort of, you know, pits classes against each other, who gets when, what, and where. But if you think about the sustainability of something that is popular, and that is the welfare state in Europe, then what is very important is to look at the denominator of this equation. So if you invest in the number of workers, higher levels of employment, and in their average production, then you can, through taxes and contribution, easily sustain a welfare state. But the debate that we often have is about the number of people supported by the welfare state. Oh, that's a lot. There should be less. So we have to fiddle with the eligibility conditions. And the average consumption or the benefits per welfare recipient, that's also a lot. You know, we have to lower that in order to incentivize them to go back into the labor market. And again, you know, Daniel's figure just now shows that the number of discouraged workers in the U.S., where there is little of a welfare state, that problem is much bigger in the U.S. than in Europe. I mean, it may not be a problem for the U.S. because, you know, it has less of a welfare state, but it would be a problem for the EU. And that's exactly why countries have been moving in the direction to raise employment levels, because it's very difficult politically to restrain and retrench the welfare state. So, you know, you better then invest in people as a second best solution. But again, the political debate is still, you know, pitting the hardworking Dutchmen or Englishmen against the non-hardworking, non-Brit or Dutchman or German or what have you. So when we think about, okay, so what are then the core functions of the social investment welfare state if it's not pure social protection? And I think my summary version is kind of the following, and it begins with, you know, again, you know, this is a framework, right? So I'm not sure whether it still works. But the point is that the social risk of the life course in our, you know, flexible labor markets is that these social risks have become less predictable than they were in the industrial era, when a pure Bismarckian social insurance system still worked and paid off. So if you cannot, you know, insure ex post for contingency, then you have to do something ex ante. And so it's about raising the quality of human capital stock over the life course, from the young to the old. And that has, we know from research that it has a huge amount of cumulative returns. So if you do early childhood education well, then, you know, this person who has, you know, been through that will be much easier helped with active labor market policy if she, he or she loses a job 20 years hence. The second function is to ease the flow of contemporary labor transitions in line with these gender life course dynamics. So having a child, child care, paid leave, because those are the best guarantees that parents, you know, get back in the labor market at the same level that they have left the labor market. And then because there is more volatility in our labor markets, you need universal safety nets. So if there is a personal crisis or there is a financial crisis like we had, it's very important to have these buffers, you know, both at the, for the macro stabilization, but also for micro level household income. And, you know, and all the evidence since the crisis have proven that this kind of policy mix is superior to having no safety net, or to have a very fragmented safety nets that are only catering for insiders. Now, that's easier said than done, because, you know, the devil, of course, is in the institutional complementarities. How do you align stock flows and buffers? And that's different in different contexts. There is no, you know, one size fits all here. And I mean, this, there should be an error around this, but apparently it doesn't show in that picture, and it does on this picture. So the fundamental conjecture of the social investment perspective, and this, I mean, you know, this is a summary of, you know, 3,000 pages of OECD report, is that, you know, if you do early childhood education and care well, that has a knock-on effect positively on educational attainment. Educational attainment correlates with higher levels of employment. If you support that with dual earner work-life balance policies, then that has an even greater knock-on effect on female employment. So, you know, aggregate employment goes up even further. And it may have a positive effect on fertility, which then also, you know, eases the burden on the pension problem 30 years hence. And, you know, if that is followed through in the life course, then with active aging policy, you get a higher exit age as a result. And then, you know, this is a spillover, so you get more returns on your taxes, so governments could do more on poverty protection and prevention. Now, the general sort of policy response of governments who get this right is to then say at the end of the equation, you know, there's money to spare. Let's, you know, let's be popular with the voters and lower taxes. And that's what they should not do. They should, you know, invest again in the life course multiplier and work on the institutional complementarities of stock flows and buffers. But the evidence is quite convincing. I say quite convincing because, you know, it's a difficult argument to make nevertheless, because there is temporal complexity. Social investment is often thought of as, okay, you invest now in early childhood care, for instance, and then you reap the returns 20 years later. So for politicians, that's not attractive if they want to win the next election. Then social investment is multifaceted, given these functional complementarities. And of course, they overlap. I mean, take the examples of a good income buffer. That's not just a buffer policy. For families with children, parents who do not worry about, you know, the benefit that they get at the end of the month, it's much better for the learning capabilities of their children to have that kind of stability. So there's massive overlap and synergy, and you need to think that through. And it has implications for different categories of people. So we tend to think about the welfare state in aggregate terms, think about employment, or think about redistribution, but redistribution for who? Employment for who? I mean, these are, so we really need to disaggregate some of these notions, and this is the kind of work that I'm doing right now. So we kind of have to move away from a pars pro toto understanding of the welfare state, especially in terms of redistribution. But in the literature, there are quite strong sort of theoretical priors. So the first thing, there are interaction effects, so we can test that. The second thing is, you know, social investment supposedly has a positive impact of labor market flow, of labor productivity through stock, and there is group variation. And the question is it inclusive or exclusive? Then there is a critical literature that says, you know, well, you know, social investment crowds out these buffers. So there are, you know, they're not synergetic. They really are in competition with another. And these things can all be put to the test. And I've got 2 minutes. So what I've tried to do for the European Commission recently is to introduce a particular methodology for assessing social investment returns, whereby I look at simple statistics, look at, you know, basic correlations and see how countries perform. And then, you know, social investment correlates with high employment, high productivity, and correlates, this is very interesting, high spending on capacitating social services correlates with high spending on social protection. So, and the logic of it is that, you know, if countries are committed to high levels of social protection, they want to get people back into the labor force as soon as possible. So, you know, if you cannot retrench, your activating policy should really work. And this is kind of the Scandinavian experience, although Germany and the Netherlands have moved in that direction. And then I kind of test it at the micro level, in a more econometric sense. And that kind of confirms that, yes, social investment has a positive impact on employment, and that a truly narrow focus of social protection, like Italy and France, is associated with lower levels of employment. And that's another important finding. And that there is no Matthew effect, so crowding out effect, when it comes to active labor market policy. Statistically, a little bit of a Matthew effect in early childhood education and care. But if you then, and this is what you really need to do, you need to then go into the country level, because you have these scatter plots, and some countries are, you know, on the mean, and some are above the high performance and low performance. Because then you need to do qualitative work on how these institutional complementarities in these cases work. And we highlighted the case of Denmark, Germany, and Italy. And indeed, what you find is in Denmark, you know, the three functions, stock flow and buffers, are quite positively aligned. And in a country like Italy, they're highly fragmentary. So the point that was made during the day of the importance of institutional capabilities, especially for public administration, is really striking. I want to shift to my sort of proposal, because, you know, I have only 1 minute left. So go back to the talk that Laszlo Andor gave this morning. We kind of know that, you know, rule-based fiscal policy is here to stay, given the veto, Germany, Schäuble. So, you know, fiscal risk pooling, unemployment insurance, you know, that's still a long way off. But the evidence from the OECD and from my own work and others that you know, social investment is really almost a no-risk policy, and it has, you know, a huge rate of return. And if you don't do it, you know, your aging probably is going to intensify dramatically, and we know that this is going to happen anyway. And then there is a need to kind of bolster reform ownership, and there is a mood today in Europe. It's rather xenophobic. So I mean, there's a real political incentive to think about, oh my God, you know, what can we do? And so here, this goes back to your proposal of the golden rule earlier today, is to say, okay, let's exempt from the Stability and Growth Pact only the human capital stock function. So countries are allowed to spend, let's say, up to, I mean, it's to be discussed, for 1.5% of GDP in the way that they want to upgrade their skill portfolio. And Italy can move into early childhood education and care. That has a knock-on effect because it creates women, you know, here and now, and that's badly needed. And you know, France could think of, you know, trying to do something with their vocational education and training system. And you know, in my country, our active aging policies are there, but they're highly regressive. So that's, I mean, there's room for maneuver there. And then you embed it in a, you know, inclusive growth strategy, in which you put at the center this, you know, whatever happens to human capital stock, but what you follow is the institutional complementarities with these other functions, whether, you know, the buffers are adequate to resist a new shock, or whether there are leave policies that sort of, you know, work with the new flow of the labor market. And I think, I mean, this is a very humble proposal. But it not only makes sense economically, it also makes sense socially, of course, and it makes sense politically, because it shows, in a way, and of course, you know, the EU should care about people, but, you know, sometimes it's painted as, you know, the EU doesn't care. I mean, only cares, I mean, to be a bit demagogic, which, you know, getting a nice job at Goldman and Sachs. So I think this is doable, but again, you know, going back to many of the discussions we had today, you know, is this framework correct? We have to discuss that, I think, later. And very importantly, you know, it's a change of perspective. And you know, changing perspectives is very, very painful, especially for policymakers. So the unlearning is the most difficult part of any learning exercise. And in the case of Europe, that's further complicated by the fact that we actually have an outdated policy theory, but we cast it in stone. You know, it's part of the Maastricht Treaty. And that's, I think that's hugely problematic. Thanks very much.